Chapter 6. Looking Backward. How the planters, having lost the war for slavery, sought to begin again where they left off in 1860, merely substituting for the individual ownership of slaves a new state serfdom of black folk. The young Southern fanatic who murdered Abraham Lincoln said, according to the New York Times, April 21, 1865, "This country was formed for the white, not the black man." And looking upon African slavery from the same standpoint held by the noble framers of our Constitution, I, for one, have ever considered it of the greatest blessings, both for themselves and us, that God ever bestowed upon a favored nation. Witness heretofore our wealth and power, witness their elevation and enlightenment above their race elsewhere. I have lived among it most of my life, and have seen less harsh treatment from master to man than I have beheld in the North from father to son. Yet heaven knows, no one would be willing to do more for the Negro race than I, could I but see a way to still better their condition. But Lincoln's policy is only preparing the way for their total annihilation. The South had risked war to protect this system of labor and to expand it into a triumphant empire. And even if all of the Southerners did not agree with this broader program, even these had risked war in order to ward off the disaster of a free labor class, either white or black. Yet they had failed. After a whirlwind of battles in which the South had put energy, courage, and skill, and most of their money, in the face of inner bickerings and divided councils, jealousy of leaders, indifference of poor whites, and the general strike of black labor, they had failed in their supreme effort, and now found themselves with much of their wealth gone, their land widely devastated, and some of it confiscated, their slaves declared free, and their country occupied by a hostile army. The South faced all sorts of difficulties. The hostilities, military and naval, had practically destroyed the whole commercial system of the South and reduced the people to a pitiable, primitive, almost barbaric level. It has been said that the ruining of the planting class in the South through war was more complete than the destruction of the nobility and clergy in the French Revolution. The very foundations of the system were shattered. There was at the end of the war no civil authority with power in North and South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, and Texas, and in the other states, authority was only functioning in part under Congress or the President. The Northern soldiers were transported home with provisions for their comfort and often with royal welcomes, while the Southern soldiers walked home in poverty and disillusioned. Lands had deteriorated because of the failure to use fertilizers. The marketing of the crops was difficult, and the titles to land and crops disputed. Government officials seized much of the produce, and the cotton tax of 3 cents a pound bore hard upon the planters. The mortality of the whites was so great in the decade following 1865 as to be a matter of common remark. When a right and just cause loses, men suffer. But men also suffer when a wrong cause loses. Suffering thus in itself does not prove the justice or injustice of a cause. It always, however, points a grave moral. Certainly, after the war, no one could restrain his sorrow at the destruction and havoc brought upon the whites. Least of all were the Negroes unsympathetic. Perhaps never in the history of the world have victims given so much of help and sympathy to their former oppressors. Yet the most pitiable victims of the war were not the rich planters, but the poor workers, not the white race, but the black. Naturally, the mass of the planters were bitterly opposed to the abolition of slavery. First, they based their opposition upon a lifelong conviction that free Negro labor could not be made profitable. The New Orleans Picayune said, July 8, 1862, "In sober earnest, we say, and we believe, all who know anything from observation or experience will corroborate our assertion that this is an absolute impossibility. There could be no full crop produced under that system. The earlier processes might be performed in a manner and to some extent, but the latter, and more arduous, those upon the prompt performance of which depends the production of any crop at all, would be slighted, if not indeed entirely lost. The thriftless, thoughtless Negro would jingle his last month's wages in the planter's face and tell him to do the rest of the work himself. Look at Jamaica, Barbados, Antigua, and the other British West Indies, where this experiment is having a most suggestive trial. The Texas Republican, a weekly newspaper, said, "The ruinous effects of freeing 4 millions of ignorant and helpless blacks would not be confined to the South, but the blight would be communicated to the North, and the time would come when the people of that section would be glad to witness a return to a system attended with more philanthropy and happiness to the black race than the one they seemed determined to establish, for they will find that compulsory labor affords larger crops and a richer market for Yankee manufacturers." The masters were advised, therefore, not to turn their slaves loose to become demoralized, but to maintain a kind and protecting care over them. In addition to this, it was said that even if the free Negro labor miraculously proved profitable, Negroes themselves were impossible as freemen, neighbors, and citizens. They could not be educated and really civilized. And beyond that, if a free, educated black citizen and voter could be brought upon the stage, this would in itself be the worst conceivable thing on earth. Worse than shiftless, unprofitable labor, worse than ignorance, worse than crime. It would lead inevitably to a mulatto South and the eventual ruin of all civilization. This was a natural reaction for a country educated as the South had been, and that the mass of the planters passionately believed it is beyond question, despite difficulties of internal logic. Even the fact that some thought free Negro labor practicable, and many knew perfectly well that at least some Negroes were capable of education and even of culture, these stood like a rock wall against anything further, against Negro citizens, against Negro voters, against any social recognition in politics, religion, or culture. The poor whites, on the other hand, were absolutely at sea. The Negro was to become, apparently, their fellow laborer, but were the whites to be bound to the black laborer by economic condition and destiny, or rather to the white planter by community of blood? Almost unanimously, following the reaction of such leaders as Andrew Johnson and Hinton Helper, the poor white clung frantically to the planter and his ideals, and although ignorant and impoverished, maimed and discouraged, victims of war, fought largely by the poor white for the benefit of the rich planter, they sought redress by demanding unity of white against black, and not unity of poor against rich or of worker against exploiter. This brought singular schism in the South. The white planter endeavored to keep the Negro at work for his own profit on terms that amounted to slavery and which were hardly distinguishable from it. This was the plain voice of the slave codes. On the other hand, the only conceivable ambition of a poor white was to become a planter. Meantime, the poor white did not want the Negro put to profitable work. He wanted the Negro beneath the feet of the white worker. Right here had lain the seat of the trouble before the war. All the regular and profitable jobs went to Negroes, and the poor whites were excluded. It seemed after the war immaterial to the poor white that profit from the exploitation of black labor continued to go to the planter. He regarded the process as the exploitation of black folk by white, not of labor by capital. When, then, he faced the possibility of being himself compelled to compete with a Negro wage worker, while both were the hirelings of a white planter, his whole soul revolted. He turned, therefore, from war service to guerrilla warfare, particularly against Negroes. He joined eagerly secret organizations like the Ku Klux Klan, which fed his vanity by making him co-worker with the white planter and gave him a chance to maintain his race superiority by killing and intimidating niggers. And even in secret forays of his own, he could drive away the planter's black help, leaving the land open to white labor. Or he could murder 2 successful freedmen. It was only when they saw the Negro with a vote in his hand, backed by the power and money of the nation, that the poor whites, who followed some of the planters into the ranks of the scalawags, began to conceive of an economic solidarity between white and black workers. In this interval, they received at the hands of the black voter and his allies a more general right to vote, to hold office, and to receive education, privileges which the planter had always denied them. But before all this was so established as to be intelligently recognized, armed revolt in the South became organized by the planters with the cooperation of the mass of poor whites. Taking advantage of an industrial crisis which throttled both democracy and industry in the North, this combination drove the Negro back toward slavery. Finally, the poor whites joined the sons of the planters and disfranchised the black laborer, thus nullifying the labor movement in the South for a half century and more. As the Civil War staggered toward its end, the country began to realize that it was not only at the end of an era, but it was facing the beginning of a vaster and more important cycle. The emancipation of 4 million slaves might end slavery, but would it not also be the end of its 4 million victims? To be sure, there were many prophets, South and North, who foretold this fate of Negro extinction, but they were wrong. It was the beginning of Negro development, and what was this development going to be? Back of all the enthusiasm and fervor of victory in the North came a wave of reflection that represented the sober afterthought of the nation. It harked back to a time when not one person in 10 believed in Negroes, or in emancipation, or in any attempt to conquer the South. This feeling began to arise before the war closed, and after it ended, it rose higher and higher into something like dismay. From before the time of Washington and Jefferson down to the Civil War, the nation had asked if it were possible for free Negroes to become American citizens in the full sense of the word. The answers to this problem historically had taken these forms. 1. Negroes, after conversion to Christianity, were in the same position as other colonial subjects of the British king. This attitude disappeared early in colonial history. 2. When the slave trade was stopped, Negroes would die out. Therefore, the attack upon slavery must begin with the abolition of the slave trade, and after that, the race problem would settle itself. This attitude was back of the slave trade laws, 1808 to 1820. 3. If Negroes did not die out, and if gradually by emancipation and the economic failure of slavery they became free, they must be systematically deported out of the country, back to Africa or elsewhere, where they would develop into an independent people or die from laziness or disease. This represented the attitude of liberal America from the end of the War of 1812 down to the beginning of the Cotton Kingdom. 4. Negroes were destined to be perpetual slaves in a new economy which recognized a caste of slave workers, and this caste system might eventually displace the white worker. At any rate, it was destined to a wider expansion toward the tropics. This was the attitude of the Confederacy. It is clear that from the time of Washington and Jefferson, down to the Civil War, when the nation was asked if it was possible for free Negroes to become American citizens in the full sense of the word, it answered by a stern and determined no. The persons who conceived the Negroes as free and remaining in the United States were a small minority before 1861 and confined to educated free Negroes and some of the abolitionists. The basic thought of the American nation now began gradually to be changed. It bore the face of fear. It showed a certain dismay at the thought of what the nation was facing after the war and under hypnotism of a philanthropic idea. The very joy in the shout of emancipated Negroes was a threat. Who were these people? Were we not losing a sort of guerrilla into American freedom? Negroes were lazy, poor, and ignorant. Moreover, their ignorance was more than the ignorance of whites. It was a biological, fundamental, and irreducible ignorance based on pronounced and eternal racial differences. The democracy and freedom open and possible to white men of English stock, and even to continental Europeans, were unthinkable in the case of Africans. We were moving slowly in an absolutely impossible direction. Meantime, there was anarchy in the South and the triumph of brute physical force over large areas. The classic report on conditions in the South directly after the war is that of Carl Schurz. Karl Schurz was the finest type of immigrant Americans. A German of education and training, he had fought for liberal thought and government in his country, and when driven out by the failure of the Revolution of 1848, had come to the United States, where he fought for freedom. No man was better prepared dispassionately to judge conditions in the South than Schurz. He was, to be sure, an idealist and doctrinaire, but surely the hard-headed and the practical had made mess enough with America. This was a time for thought and plan. Schurz reports on his journey remain today with every internal evidence of truth and reliability. His mission came about in this way. He had written Johnson on his North Carolina effort at Reconstruction, and Johnson invited him to call. President Johnson received me with the assurance that he had read my letters with great interest and appreciation, and that he was earnestly considering the views I had presented in them. But in one respect, he said, I had entirely mistaken his intentions. His North Carolina proclamation was not to be understood as laying down a general rule for the reconstruction of all the states lately in rebellion. It was to be regarded as merely experimental, and he thought that the condition of things in North Carolina was especially favorable for the making of such an experiment. As to the Gulf states, he was very doubtful and even anxious. He wished to see those states restored to their constitutional relations with the general government as quickly as possible, but he did not know whether it could be done with safety to the Union men and to the emancipated slaves. He therefore requested me to visit those states for the purpose of reporting to him whatever information I could gather as to the existing condition of things, and of suggesting to him such measures as my observations might lead me to believe advisable. In his report, Schurz differentiated four classes in the South. 1. Those who, although having yielded submission to the national government only when obliged to do so, have a clear perception of the irreversible changes produced by the war, and honestly endeavor to accommodate themselves to the new order of things. 2. Those whose principal object is to have the states without delay restored to their position and influence in the Union, and the people of the states to the absolute control of their home concerns. They are ready, in order to attain that object, to make any ostensible concession that will not prevent them from arranging things to suit their taste as soon as that object is attained. 3. The incorrigibles, who still indulge in the swagger which was so customary before and during the war, and still hope for a time when the Southern Confederacy will achieve its independence. 4. The multitude of people who have no definite ideas about the circumstances under which they live, and about the course they have to follow, whose intellects are weak, but whose prejudices and impulses are strong, and who are apt to be carried along by those who know how to appeal to the latter. He thus describes the movement immediately following the war. When the war came to a close, the labor system of the South was already much disturbed. During the progress of military operations, large number of slaves had left their masters and followed the columns of our armies. Others had taken refuge in our camps. Many thousands had enlisted in the service of the national government. Extensive settlements of Negroes had been formed along the seaboard and the banks of the Mississippi under the supervision of army officers and treasury agents, and the government was feeding the colored refugees who could not be advantageously employed in the so-called contraband camps. Many slaves had also been removed by their masters as our armies penetrated the country, either to Texas or to the interior of Georgia and Alabama. Thus, a considerable portion of the laboring force had been withdrawn from its former employment. But a majority of the slaves remained on the plantations to which they belonged, especially in those parts of the country which were not touched by the war, and were, consequently, the Emancipation Proclamation was not enforced by the military power. Although not ignorant of the stake they had in the result of the contest, the patient bondmen waited quietly for the development of things. But as soon as the struggle was finally decided and our forces were scattered about in detachments to occupy the country, the so far unmoved masses began to stir. The report went among them that their liberation was no longer a mere contingency, but a fixed fact. Large numbers of colored people left the plantations. Many flocked to our military posts and camps to obtain the certainty of their freedom, and others walked away merely for the purpose of leaving the places on which they had been held in slavery, and because they could now go with impunity. Still others, and their number was by no means inconsiderable, remained with their former masters and continued their work on the field, but under new and as yet unsettled conditions, and under the agitating influence of a feeling of restlessness. In some localities, however, where our troops had not yet penetrated, and where no military post was within reach, planters endeavored and partially succeeded in maintaining between themselves and the Negroes the relation of master and slave, partly by concealing from them the great changes that had taken place, and partly by terrorizing them into submission to their behests. But aside from those exceptions, the country found itself thrown into that confusion which is naturally inseparable from a change so great and so sudden. The white people were afraid of the Negroes, and the Negroes did not trust the white people. The military power of the national government stood there and was looked up to as the protector of both. Some of the planters with whom I had occasion to converse expressed their determination to adopt the course which best accords with the spirit of free labor, to make the Negro work by offering him fair inducements, to stimulate his ambition, and to extend to him those means of intellectual and moral improvement which are best calculated to make him an intelligent, reliable, and efficient free laborer, and a good and useful citizen. I regret to say that views and intentions so reasonable I found confined to a small minority. Aside from the assumption that the Negro will not work without physical compulsion, there appears to be another popular notion prevalent in the South, which stands as no less serious an obstacle in the way of a successful solution of the problem. It is that the Negro exists for the special object of raising cotton, rice, and sugar for the whites, and that it is illegitimate for him to indulge, like other people, in the pursuit of his own happiness in his own way. I made it a special point in most of the conversations I had with Southern men to inquire into their views with regard to this subject. I found, indeed, some gentlemen of thought and liberal ideas who readily acknowledged the necessity of providing for the education of the colored people and who declared themselves willing to cooperate to that end to the extent of their influence. Some planters thought of establishing schools on their estates, and others would have been glad to see measures taken to that effect by the people of the neighborhoods in which they lived. But whenever I asked the question whether it might be hoped that the legislatures of their states or their county authorities would make provisions for Negro education, I never received an affirmative, and only in two or three instances feebly encouraging answers. At last, I was forced to the conclusion that, aside from a small number of honorable exceptions, the popular prejudice is almost as bitterly set against the Negroes having the advantage of education as it was when the Negro was a slave. There may be an improvement in that respect, but it would prove only how universal the prejudice was in former days. Hundreds of times I heard the old assertion repeated that learning will spoil the nigger for work, and that Negro education will be the ruin of the South. Another most singular notion still holds a potent sway over the minds of the masses. It is that the elevation of the blacks will be the degradation of the whites. The emancipation of the slaves is submitted to only insofar as chattel slavery in the old form could not be kept up. But although the freedman is no longer considered the property of the individual master, he is considered the slave of society, and all independent state legislation will share the tendency to make him such. The ordinances abolishing slavery, passed by the conventions under the pressure of circumstances, will not be looked upon as barring the establishment of a new form of servitude. Carl Schurz summed the matter up. Wherever I go, the street, the shop, the house, the hotel, or the steamboat, I hear the people talk in such a way as to indicate that they are yet unable to conceive of the Negro as possessing any rights at all. Men who are honorable in their dealings with their white neighbors will cheat a Negro without feeling a single twinge of their honor. To kill a Negro they do not deem murder. To debauch a Negro woman they do not think fornication. To take the property away from a Negro, they do not consider robbery. The people boast that when they get freedmen's affairs in their own hands, to use their own expression, the niggers will catch hell. The reason of all this is simple and manifest. The whites esteem the blacks their property by natural right. And however much they admit that the individual relations of masters and slaves have been destroyed by the war and by the President's Emancipation Proclamation, they still have an ingrained feeling that the blacks at large belong to the whites at large. Corroboration of the main points in the thesis of Schurz came from many sources. From Virginia. Before the abolition of slavery, and before the war, it was the policy of slaveholders to make a free Negro as despicable a creature and as uncomfortable as possible. They did not want a free Negro about at all. They considered it an injury to the slave, as it undoubtedly was, creating discontent among the slaves. The consequences were that there was always an intense prejudice against the free Negro. Now, very suddenly, all have become free Negroes, and that was not calculated to allay that prejudice. A colored man testified. There was a distinct tendency toward compulsion, toward reestablished slavery under another name. Negroes coming into Yorktown from regions of Virginia and thereabout, said that they had worked all year and received no pay and were driven off the 1st of January. The owners sold their crops and told them they had no further use for them and that they might go to the Yankees, or the slaveholders offered to take them back but refused to pay any wages. A few offered a dollar a month and clothing and food. They were not willing to pay anything for work. The courts aided the subjection of Negroes. George S. Smith of Virginia, resident since 1848, said that he had been in the provost marshal's department and have had great opportunities of seeing the cases that are brought before him. Although I am prejudiced against the Negro myself, still I must tell the truth and must acknowledge that he has rights. In more than 9 cases out of 10 that have come up in General Patrick's office, the Negro has been right and the white man has been wrong, and I think that that will be found to be the case if you examine the different provost marshals. It was common for Virginians in 1865 and 1866 to advocate wholesale expulsion of the Negroes. This attitude arose from the slave trade. The slave system in Virginia has been such as to exhaust very largely the able-bodied laborers. I have been informed that 20,000 of that class were annually sold from Virginia. Consequently, a very large portion of the colored population there is composed of the aged, infirm, women and children, and the being freed from the necessity of supporting them is really a great relief in the present poverty of the people, a relief to their former owners. Of course, those who wanted Negro labor immediately and were pushed on by the current high prices for products were willing to compromise in some respects. The more intelligent people there, those who have landed estates, need their labor. Being dependent upon them for labor, they see the necessity of employing them and are disposed to get along with them. All of the people, however, are extremely reluctant to grant the Negro his civil rights, those privileges that pertain to freedom, the protection of life, liberty, and property before the laws, the right to testify in the courts, etc. They are all very reluctant to concede that, and if it is ever done, it will be because they are forced to do it. They are reluctant even to consider and treat the Negro as a free man. Lieutenant Sanderson, who was in North Carolina for 3 years, said that as soon as the Southerners came in full control, they intended to put in force laws not allowing a contraband to stay in any section over such a length of time without work. If he does, to seize him and sell him. In fact, that is done now in the county of Gates, North Carolina. The county police, organized under orders from headquarters, did enforce that. Mr. Parker told me that he had hired his people for the season, that directly after the surrender of General Lee, he called them up and told them they were free, that he was better used to them than to others and would prefer hiring them, that he would give them board and 2 suits of clothing to stay with him till the first day of January 1866, and 1 Sunday suit at the end of that time, that they consented willingly, in fact, preferred to remain with him, etc. But from his people I learned that though he did call them up, as stated, yet when one of them demurred at the offer, his son James flew at him and cuffed and kicked him, and that after that they were all perfectly willing to stay. They were watched night and day. That Bob, one of the men, had been kept chained nights. That they were actually afraid to try to get away. Sometimes the resentment at the new state of affairs was funny. A county judge near Goldsboro, who had never been addressed by a Negro unbidden, came to the quarters of Lieutenant Sanderson. "Lieutenant, what am I to stand from these freed people? I suppose you call them free. What insults am I obliged to suffer? I am in a perfect fever." I told him I saw he was, and asked him what he complained of. If there was anything wrong, I would write it. "Well," said he, "one of these infernal niggers came along as I sat on my piazza this morning and bowed to me and said, 'Good morning, one of your soldiers.'" From Alabama, it was reported, the planters hate the Negro, and the latter class distrust the former. And while this state of things continues, there cannot be harmonious action in developing the resources of the country. Besides, a good many men are unwilling yet to believe that the peculiar institution of the South has been actually abolished, and still have the lingering hope that slavery, though not in name, will yet in some form practically exist. And hence the great anxiety to get back into the Union, which being accomplished, they will then, as I have heard it expressed, fix the Negro. It is simple fact, capable of indefinite proof, that the black man does not receive the faintest shadow of justice. I aver that in 9 cases out of 10, within my own observation, where a white man has provoked an affray with a black and savagely misused him, the black man has been fined for insolent language because he did not receive the chastisement in submissive silence, while the white man has gone free. The New York Herald says of Georgia, "Springing naturally out of this disordered state of affairs is an organization of regulators, so-called. Their numbers include many ex-Confederate cavaliers of the country, and their mission is to visit summary justice upon any offenders against the public peace. It is needless to say that their attention is largely directed to maintaining quiet and submission among the blacks. The shooting or stringing up of some obstreperous nigger by the regulators is so common an occurrence as to excite little remark, nor is the work or proscription confined to the freedmen only. The regulators go to the bottom of the matter and strive to make it uncomfortably warm for any new settler with demoralizing innovations of wages for niggers." A committee of the Florida legislature reported in 1865 that it was true that one of the results of the war was the abolition of African slavery. But it will hardly be seriously argued that the simple act of emancipation of itself worked any change in the social, legal, or political status of such of the African race as were already free. Nor will it be insisted, we presume, that the emancipated slave technically dominated a freedman, occupied any higher position in the scale of rights and privileges than did the free Negro. If these inferences be correct, then it results as a logical conclusion that all the arguments going to sustain the authority of the General Assembly to discriminate in the case of free Negroes equally apply to that of freedmen or emancipated slaves. But it is insisted by a certain class of radical theorists that the act of emancipation did not stop in its effect in merely severing the relation of master and slave, but that it extended further and so operated as to exalt the entire race and placed them upon terms of perfect equality with the white man. These fanatics may be very sincere and honest in their convictions, but the result of the recent elections in Connecticut and Wisconsin shows very conclusively that such is not the sentiment of the majority of the so-called free states. Some Southerners saw in emancipation nothing but extermination for the Negro race. The provisional governor of Florida became almost tearful over the impending fate of the Negroes and the guilt of the North. This unfortunate class of our population, but recently constituting the happiest and best provided for laboring population in the world, by no act of theirs or voluntary concurrence of ours, with no prior training to prepare them for their new responsibilities, have been suddenly deprived of the fostering care and protection of their old masters, and are now to become, like so many children gambooling upon the brink of the yawning precipice, careless of the future, and intent only in reveling in the present unrestrained enjoyment of the newly found bauble of freedom. Judge Humphrey of Alabama said, "I believe, in case of a return to the Union, we would receive political cooperation so as to secure the management of that labor by those who were slaves. There is really no difference, in my opinion, whether we hold them as absolute slaves or obtain their labor by some other method. Of course, we prefer the old method, but that question is not now before us." A 12-year resident of Alabama said, "There is a kind of innate feeling, a lingering hope among many in the South, that slavery will be regalvanized in some shape or other. They tried, by their laws, to make a worse slavery than there was before, for the freedman has not now the protection which the master from interest gave him before. Every day the press of the South testifies to the outrages that are being perpetrated upon unoffending colored people by the state militia. These outrages are particularly flagrant in the states of Alabama and Mississippi, and are of such character as to demand most imperatively the interposition of the national executive. These men are rapidly inaugurating a condition of things, a feeling among the freedmen that will, if not checked, ultimate in insurrection. The freedmen are peaceable and inoffensive. Yet if the whites continue to make it all their lives are worth to go through the country as free people have a right to do, they will goad them to that point at which submission and patience cease to be a virtue. I call your attention to this matter after reading and hearing from the most authentic sources, officers and others, for weeks of the continuance of the militia robbing the colored people of their property, arms, shooting them in the public highways if they refuse to halt when so commanded, and lodging them in jail if found from home without passes, and ask as a matter of simple justice to an unoffending and downtrodden people that you use your influence to induce the president to issue an order or proclamation forbidding the organization of state militia." In Mississippi, in respectful earnestness, I must say that if all at the end of all the blood that has been shed and the treasure expended, the unfortunate Negro is to be left in the hands of his infuriated and disappointed former owners to legislate and fix his status, God help him, for his cup of bitterness will overflow indeed. Was ever such a policy conceived in the brain of men before? Sumner quotes an authority of peculiar value, a gentleman writing from Mississippi: "I regret to state that under the civil power deemed by all the inhabitants of Mississippi to be paramount, the condition of the freedmen in many portions of the country has been deplorable and painful in the extreme. I must give it as my deliberate opinion that the freedmen are today, in the vicinity where I am now writing, worse off in most respects than when they were held slaves. If matters are permitted to continue on, as they now seem likely to be, it needs no prophet to predict a rising on the part of the colored population and a terrible scene of bloodshed and desolation. Nor can anyone blame the Negroes if this proves to be the result. I have heard, since my arrival here, of numberless atrocities that have been perpetrated upon the freedmen. It is sufficient to state that the old overseers are in power again. The object of the Southerners appears to be to make good their often repeated assertions to the effect that the Negroes would die if they were freed. To make it so, they seem determined to goad them to desperation in order to have an excuse to turn upon and annihilate them. General Fisk, early in 1866, said, "I have today received the statement of two very respectable colored men who went into northern Mississippi from Nashville and rented plantations. Both of them were men of means, and one a reputed son of Isham G. Harris, a former governor of Tennessee. Both were very intelligent colored men. They have been driven out and warned not to put their feet within the state again. Their written statements and affidavits I have, and will cheerfully place them in the hands of the committee if they desire it. They are reliable men. I know them both." A former Mississippi slaveholder wrote, "As a man who has been deprived of a large number of persons he once claimed as slaves, I protest against such a course. If it is intended to follow up the abolition of slavery by a liberal and enlightened policy, by which I mean bestowing upon them the full rights of other citizens, then I can give this movement my heart and hand. But if the Negro is to be left in a helpless condition, far more miserable than that of slavery, I would ask what was the object of taking him from those who claimed his services. General Chetlain tells us that while he was in command for 2 months of the Jackson District, containing 9 counties, there was an average of 1 black man killed every day, and that in moving out 40 miles on an expedition, he found 7 Negroes wantonly butchered. Colonel Thomas, Assistant Commissioner of the Freedmen's Bureau for this state, tells us that there is now a daily average of 2 or 3 black men killed in Mississippi. The sable patriots in blue, as they return, are the objects of especial spite." Governor Sharkey of Mississippi said, "My expectation concerning them is that they are destined to extinction, beyond all doubt. We must judge of the future by the past. I could tell you a great many circumstances to that effect. I am sorry I did not come prepared with means to state the percentage of deaths among them. It is alarming, appalling, I think, that they will gradually die out." General Fisk received a letter from a rich planter living in DeSoto County, Mississippi. He had on his plantation a little girl, and wrote me a long letter in relation to it, which closed up by saying, "As to recognizing the rights of freedmen to their children, I will say there is not one man or woman in all the South who believes they are free, but we consider them as stolen property, stolen by the bayonets of the damnable United States government. Yours truly, T. Yancey." There is one thing that must be taken into account, and that is, there will exist a very strong disposition among the masters to control these people and keep them as a subordinate and subjected class. Undoubtedly, they intend to do that. I think the tendency to establish a system of serfdom is the great danger to be guarded against. I talked with a planter in the LaForche district near Thibodeauville. He said he was not in favor of secession. He avowed his hope and expectation that slavery would be restored there in some form. I said, "If we went away and left these people now, do you suppose you could reduce them to slavery?" He laughed to scorn the idea that they could not. "What," said I, "these men who have had arms in their hands?" "Yes," he said. "We should take the arms away from them, of course." There was no inconsiderable number of Southerners who stoutly maintained that Negroes were not free. The Planters' Party of Louisiana in 1864 proposed to revive the Constitution of 1852 with all its slavery features. They believed that Lincoln had emancipated the slaves in the rebellious parts of the country as a war measure. Slavery remained intact within the federal lines, except as to the return of fugitives, and might be reinstated everywhere at the close of hostilities, or, in any case, compensation might be obtained by loyal citizens through the decision of the Supreme Court. The situation in Texas was peculiar. During the war, Texan produce had been sent to Europe by the way of Mexico, and a steady stream of cash came in, which made slavery all the more valuable. At the end of the war, slavery was essentially unimpaired. When the federal soldiers approached, some of the planters set their Negroes free, and some Negroes ran away. But most of the Negroes were kept on the plantations to await federal action, and there was widespread belief that slavery was an institution and would continue in some form. The Houston, Texas Telegraph was of the opinion that emancipation was certain to take place, but that compulsory labor would replace slavery, since the Negro was to be freed by the federal government solely with a view to the safety of the Union. His condition would be modified only so far as to ensure this, but not so far as materially to weaken the agricultural resources of the country. Therefore, the Negroes would be compelled to work under police regulations of a stringent character. Mr. Sumner reported in 1866 a special slave trade from the South to the West Indies and South America. Another big trade is going on, that of running Negroes to Cuba and Brazil. They are running through the country dressed in Yankee clothes, hiring men, giving them any price they ask to make turpentine on the bay, sometimes on the rivers, sometimes to make sugar. They get them on the cars. Of course, the Negro don't know where he is going. They get him to the bay and tell him to go on the steamer to go around the coast, and away goes poor Cuffy to slavery again. They are just cleaning out this section of the country of the likeliest men and women in it. Federal officers are mixed up in it, too. So much for the attitude of the owning class, the former slaveholders. But the great mass of the Southerners were not slaveholders. They were white peasant farmers, artisans, with a few merchants and professional men. Large numbers of these were fed by the federal government and formed a considerable proportion of the fugitives after the war. General Hatch reported in 1866, "The poorer classes of the white people have an intense dislike toward Negroes in Mississippi." 5/6 of the soldiers in the Confederate Army were not slave owners and had fought against the competition of Negroes and for their continued slavery. The most discouraging feature was the utter helplessness of the white community in the face of the terrible problem. Almost any thoughtful traveler could see that the majority of the whites were parasites, idlers, and semi-vagabonds. According to Sidney Andrews, "The Negro, as bad as his condition is," said he, "seems to me, on the whole, to accommodate himself more easily than the whites to the changed situation. I should say that the question at issue in the South is not what shall be done with the Negro, but what shall be done with the whites." The blacks managed to live comfortably for the most part and help each other, but the whites, accustomed to having all their affairs managed by an aristocracy which was then ruined, seemed powerless. They chose committees and reported cases of suffering, but any organized action on a large scale could not be expected. It was hoped that aid for the whites would come from the North, but fearful distress from hunger was inevitable. General Turner said of the conditions in Virginia, "Among the lower classes of the whites there is a spirit of aggression against the Negro, and a great many of the Negroes are inclined to take the thing in their own hands. They are not disposed to be imposed upon by those people, if they can have half a show to defend themselves. With the lower classes, I speak now more particularly of the city of Richmond, probably the feeling does not exist to such an extent in the rural districts. There is an impulsive feeling of aggression, a desire to get the Negro out of the way. They do not think of his rights. They do not appear to know what it means. Only they feel that the Negro has something." General Fisk spoke of Tennessee. "It is a melancholy fact that among the bitterest opponents of the Negro in Tennessee are the intensely radical loyalists of the Mountain District, the men who have been in our armies. The poorer classes of the white people have an intense dislike toward them," said General Hatch. He especially emphasized the situation in Tennessee and spoke of the aid that was being given the white fugitives. He said that the Negro knew that, without legal rights, he was not safe from the poor whites, and that they had not issued to the Negroes 1/10 of the rations that they had given the poor whites. The hatred toward the Negro as a freeman is intense among the low and brutal, who are the vast majority. Murders, shootings, whippings, robbing, and brutal treatment of every kind are daily inflicted upon them, and I am sorry to say in most cases they can get no redress. They don't know where to complain or how to seek justice after they have been abused and cheated. The habitual deference toward the white man makes them fearful of his anger and revenge. The union members of the Tennessee legislature said that long before the war, common laborers had learned to curse the Yankees and abolitionists and to talk about Negro equality and his rights in the territories. With all this went a great degree of personal violence. Leaving out for the moment the group violence, the organized fight against the Negro, which was continuous, the personal physical opposition was continually in existence. A candidate for Congress in Virginia in 1865 said, "I am opposed to the Southern states being taxed at all for the redemption of this national debt, either directly or indirectly, and I will vote to repeal all laws that have heretofore been passed for that purpose. And in doing so, I do not consider that I violate any obligations to which the South was a party. We have never plighted our faith for the redemption of the war debt. The people will be borne down with taxes for years to come, even if the war debt is repudiated. It will be the duty of the government to support the maimed and disabled soldiers, and this will be a great expense. And if the United States government requires the South to be taxed for the support of Union soldiers, we should insist that all disabled soldiers should be maintained by the United States government without regard to the side they had taken in the war. The national debt doubtless seems to you beyond the reach of any hand, yet I regard it as very probable that one or two or all of three things will be attempted within 3 years after the Southern members of Congress are admitted to seats: the repudiation of the national debt, the assumption of the Confederate debt, or the payment of several $100 million to the South for property destroyed and slaves emancipated." A leader from South Carolina, James H. Campbell, said, "I believe that when our votes are admitted into that Congress, if we are tolerably wise, governed by a moderate share of common sense, we will have our own way. I am speaking now not to be reported. We will have our own way yet if we are true to ourselves. We know the past. We know not what is to be our future. Are we not in a condition to accept what we cannot help? Are we not in a condition where it is the part of wisdom to wait and give what we cannot avoid giving? I believe as surely as we are a people, so surely, if we are guided by wisdom, we will be, by the beginning of the next presidential election, which is all that is known of the Constitution, for when you talk of the Constitution of the United States, it means the presidential election and the share of the spoils, I believe then we may hold the balance of power.